are listening to Ebony Spectrum on WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org. Let's take a look at culture this week.
Go on and grab your sweet tea and your shade fan, because this one right here, oh baby, we gotta talk. Essence Festival 2025 just showed the world what happens when culture gets hijacked, repackaged, and served back to the people who made it without the flavor, the history, or the respect. And let me tell you something, FBA folks are tired of being sidelined in spaces we built from scratch. See, Essence Festival used to be a crown jewel, a cultural pilgrimage, the Met Gala of the South for black folks. You ain't even need a lineup, just some shea butter, a two-piece linen outfit, and a flight to New Orleans. We showed up because Essence showed out. But this year, whew, it was Essence in name only. The spirit, gone. The authenticity, missing. The soul, child, somewhere hiding under a wig in aisle 7 at Target. And I ain't the only one saying it. FBA folks who grew up on Essence, we watched it evolve, grow, and unfortunately, fall all the way off in 2025. Let's unpack why. Sit tight. Essence Magazine wasn't just a publication. It was the soundtrack to our mama's coffee table. It was your auntie's favorite read before church. It was the safe space where black women, specifically foundational black American women, saw themselves reflected with dignity, grace, and pride. Founded in 1970 by four black men, yes, men, who wanted to create something that celebrated black women in a world that didn't see our beauty, Essence belonged to us. The fashion, the hair, the health tips, the political takes, the unapologetic love of our people, all of it woven together in a cultural quilt that said, this is who we are. Then came Essence Fest, the live-action tribute to all that glory. New Orleans welcomed us year after year, and we made the city our playground for black excellence. The artists, the panels, the vendors, even the uncles grilling in linen suits. It all felt like home. But now, that home feels like somebody redecorated while we were at work and didn't leave us a key. Let's talk receipts. Essence Magazine was purchased in 2018 by Richelieu Dennis, a Liberian-American businessman best known for founding Shea Moisture. And baby, from the outside, it looked like a win. Black ownership again, right? Black dollars buying black legacy. We clapped. We prayed it would mean a renaissance. But what we didn't anticipate was a shift, not just in leadership, but in cultural direction. Because Dennis turned around and appointed Caroline Wanga, a Kenyan-born executive, as CEO. And before you scream Pan-African unity, slow your roll. This ain't about beef with our African brothers and sisters. This is about lineage, leadership, and lived experience. FBA culture is specific. We ain't interchangeable. You can't swap out folks who built the house for folks who don't know the floor plan. FBA women carried Essence from obscurity to icon. So how do we now end up pushed out of decision-making, storytelling, and cultural framing? Would Kenyans let an FBA woman come to Nairobi, buy a major cultural magazine, and start running it like she grew up on Ugali and Kikuyu proverbs? Hell no. And that's no shade. That's cultural boundaries. We respect yours, but you gotta respect ours too. Now let's talk about the moment that set FBA social media on fire. The Jollof Rice versus Jambalaya contest at the 2025 Essence Fest. What? First of all, let's be clear. Jollof Rice ain't got nothing to do with FBA cuisine. It ain't what we grew up eating. It ain't at the cookout. Ain't no grandma on this side of the Atlantic serving that. No disrespect to the dish, it's a staple in West African cuisine, and that's beautiful. But to pit it against jambalaya, an FBA culinary legacy born in New Orleans? That's not just tone deaf, that's cultural erasure. Imagine going to a Jamaican festival and they hosting grits versus ackee and saltfish. It's nonsensical. That moment told us, loud and clear, that the folks running Essence no longer have a real grasp of who this festival is for. That contest was a metaphor. Our culture is being made to compete on our own turf by folks who ain't from here. And the gag is, they still got the nerve to expect us to clap. Nah, baby, we're not clapping, we're clocking it, and we got questions. Let's talk about representation, not the diversity hire version, real representation. Caroline Wanga's leadership has been marked by flashy rebranding, buzzwords, and a whole lot of global blackness talk, but not nearly enough FBA rooting. You can't run Essence like it's an international tech startup. This ain't TEDx Lagos. It's the cultural heartbeat of foundational black America. And yet, when we look at the panels, the vendors, the voices elevated at the festival, where are the core FBA thought leaders? The ones from the community's Essence claim to champion? FBA women are the backbone of this brand. So why are we now watching it morph into something that looks, sounds, and feels foreign? And before someone throws the "your xenophobic" card, let's be real. We're not mad that Africans are involved. We're mad that FBAs are being erased, silenced, and sidelined in something we created. There's a difference. And baby, the numbers tell no lies. Attendance, down 23% from the previous year. Vendor satisfaction, negative reviews flooded social media. Social engagement, flatlined. Revenue, still being counted, but early indicators show significant drops in merchandise and ticket sales. Why? Because FBA folks voted with our feet. You disrespected our palette, our legacy, our music, and expected us to still show up out of loyalty? No, ma'am. Loyalty must be earned, and you lost it. Mr. Dennis, if you're watching, and I hope you are, let me speak plain. You're the owner, yes, but you don't own the soul of Essence. That belongs to the people who built it. FBA women, writers, readers, mothers, stylists, and everyday sisters who carried this brand on their backs. If you really believe in cultural stewardship, then it's time to put real FBA women back in positions of power. Not as figureheads, not as diversity metrics, but as the heartbeat of this brand. And if you can't do that, if your ego can't take that, then do the honorable thing and sell Essence to someone who can restore its integrity. Because right now, Essence feels like it's been colonized by people who don't know how to love it right. See, this whole situation ain't just about one festival. It's about a trend, a pattern, a disturbing cycle where FBAs are used but not respected. We're good enough to be the aesthetic, good enough to be the labor. But when it's time to lead, suddenly we're too narrow, too American, too divisive. Yet everybody and they mama want to dress like us, talk like us, dance like us, and profit off our stories. Pan-Africanism without reciprocity is just exploitation in kente cloth. You don't build unity by replacing the people who laid the foundation. How we fix it? If we still care to reinstate FBA leadership, bring in women who live this culture, who feel it in their bones, put them in power, not on panels. Stop the gimmicks. We don't need international rice wars. We need real conversations, music, and food that reflects our people. Respect the culture. Not everything is for remix. Some things are sacred. Some things require you to sit back, watch, and learn. Not lead. Ownership must reflect stakeholders. Essence without FBA leadership is just a brand. Essence with FBA leadership is a movement. FBA family, let this be a wake-up call. If we don't own it, they'll ruin it. If we don't protect it, they'll dilute it. If we don't value our institutions, someone else will buy them just to burn them down quietly. The Essence Festival flop wasn't an accident. It was the result of ignoring the people who built the brand. And unless we demand better from ourselves and from those in power, this won't be the last time our culture gets treated like a costume. This year, Essence lost its soul. Not because the music was bad, not because the venue was wrong, but because the spirit was missing. And if y'all don't fix it, we gon' build our own. Again, because we always have. And this time, we'll make sure the deed is in our name.
There's some clips I wanted to play, actually, since we're talking about narratives. You know, Beyonce had the number one country album of the year. She won a Grammy, number one, best, the best. And it made the Grammys change and add another category, right? That's because this is, you set the table, and then we come and we feast at the table, and then we flip the table, and then we create the table, because we are, again, source material, and then you're mad. You know, it's like this whole affirmative action. You created this thing, you gave people these are the scores you need, this is what you need, and then when the Asian folk came and they did all of the things, you're like, oh shoot. Then you use the Asians to flip affirmative action, which benefited them more than us, and they sat and put themselves in their own, you know. Anyway, let me put that over there. But country western folk, the country music community, the CMA folk, are super mad at Shaboozey. They actually, I think they like Shaboozey. Shaboozey seems to be, I'm not saying he's Tim Scott, but I'm saying he sat there and let that girl talk about the Carters being the and didn't say, just looked at her instead of correcting. It was live TV. You could have said something, sir. I'm going to put that over there. I know you're scared. Don't want your career like you would have one without. Anyway, but Beyonce has flipped it, and she did that on purpose because she's from Texas. Mm-hmm. And what you're not going to do is tell a woman from Texas that she ain't country. You better go ahead with that. Her and K. Michelle and all of the people out there who are country. And if you play a banjo or a guitar, baby, that's African.
Right.
You know, and those stories come straight out of the plantation, the fields. Okay, all of them stories of the blues that got spun into country western. So there's a guy named Gavin Adcock. He's got cock in his name, so that means he must be a all right, why do I think like this?
Karen.
Sorry, but it's right there. Adcock. He's got, anyway, it's a big penis. He's apparently mad. He's probably mad about Beyonce, whose music is still above his on the country charts. Y'all created these categories to separate music that you would pay money to and music that you wouldn't. You demonized black people music, called it race music. You said it was going to make your white children want to do drugs and have sex with black people. So you demonized black music because it was making black kids and white kids dance together and be together. So you created this chasm. You created these categories. You said, I'm going to pay people pop music money, and then the R&B is not going to get paid. And so we've been constantly battling. It's the same. It's music. It's the same stuff. Just like books. To go into a bookstore and see a black section is, oh, anyway, let me play this clip, and I want to know what you think about this, Renee.
Okay.
Gavin.
One of them is on the Apple Music country charts, and one of them's Beyonce. You can tell her that shit ain't country music, and it ain't ever been country music, and it ain't gonna be country music.
What an ignorant,
ignorant is the
yes.
Ignorant so person. So I had this discussion with somebody, and they were saying, you know, just emphatically that Beyonce was not country music, and so I looked up what exactly does country music have to have in it? Does music have to have in it for it to be considered country? And it was, you know, like you said, I think it was like banjo or something. It wasn't banjo. I can't remember what all the instruments were. But her music had that in it. The thing that I hear in this is that it's the same, and I hate to even reach back into this administration, but it's the same way the old, you know, Secretary Brillcream is all like, we're going to take the politics out of naming ships. Changing the name of the ship is, you know, I mean, the way they did it made it political. It's the same. This is the same kind of thing. It's the same. We're not doing that anymore. And by saying we're not doing that anymore, you are doing it. You know, does that make sense? Or maybe I'm just talking. I'm just like, but it is making me crazy because they want to act like people don't see what this is. We're not stupid. Yeah. I was born at night, but not last night. You know That's what I'm right. saying? So it's really annoying because it is so juvenile and grade school tactics that they think that given with, delivered with their grade school sort of speak, and we're supposed to be, oh, okay, well, I guess you're right. No.
What do you think they're afraid of, Renee? Because, you know, it's music is supposed to bring people together. You know, I was watching a documentary called Disco's Revenge. Nile Rodgers and Jelly Bean Benitez, complicated, and put him over there. But, you know, there's a lot of Nile Rodgers in it. And I think about my childhood soundtrack. It was Donna Summers. Mm. Donna Summers was on the radio. Like, she was on the radio for like 2 years straight. You know, it's like on the radio, and there was a song on the radio. But it was, and then Michael Jackson, Off the Wall. I think that was a disco album. And you think about Chic, Nile Rodgers, that actually was just the soundtrack of hip hop. Many ways, you know, the first rap song came from a Chic song. Like, and disco left because people were dancing together and enjoying one another and doing the hustle, and it was beautiful, and it was like some angry white men killed disco and demonized disco and made it something gay, whatever. My little self, I would be getting ready in my parents' room for school, and Donna Summers would be on talking about Bad Girl, and it was, I'm 8, 9, 10 or whatever. I'm loving the songs, and you know, groove, your Boogie Nights. I mean, it's just like so many, songs, and it was joyful. And people were just mad that people were dancing together.
Yeah, you know, I saw, I'm trying to remember, what was the, I think it's the Bee Gees documentary, How Deep Is Your Love? And they talked about their career and how they had sort of ridden that disco wave until all of a sudden it was this, disco became a pariah. And yes. In that, it was almost like they hated disco so much. And they had a brother who was being featured as one of the interviewees. And he said something to the effect of, you know, it wasn't the disco that they were afraid of and that they were rebelling against. It was Black folks taking on roles that they did not feel comfortable with because they didn't feel like they should be in those positions. And that was what caused all of the ire because it was outsized. He talked about an event in Chicago at wherever the Cubs play or whoever. And they were doing this event and everybody had to bring a disco record. And it just devolved yeah. into this yeah. horrible thing. People ripping up chairs and all stuff. What? Over disco? No, that wasn't about disco. It was about something greater.
That's right.
Was, you know, called disco.
But look at the delivery system. I think it was a radio disc jockey.
Yes. It was.
That created this whole campaign to kill mm-hmm. disco.
Yeah.
And the Bee Gees, I need to watch it. Smith said it was really good. How can you bend a broken heart? I'm going to have to check that out tonight. But you think about, and we should watch these documentaries to remember mm-hmm. every time there's any kind of liberating spirit, even if we talk about hip hop, there was something going on in hip hop when You're Headed for Self-Destruction came out, and it was KRS-One, it was Chuck D, it was Poor Righteous Teachers, Leaders of the New School, and it was, we're learning actual history, you know? I mean, KRS-One is breaking it down, and you got the 5% Nation coming, like, Rakim. There were so many ways in which we were coming together and also challenging our community to be better, and then here comes this gangster rap. But it wasn't just gangster rap. It was the commercialization. It wasn't just Cop Killer and F the Police. It was then the debauchery that was in all of the bitches and the hoes and all. That came later because that first iteration of hip-hop did not tolerate right. that kind of behavior. Who are you calling a bitch? You know, like exactly. it was...
Like Sugar Hill Gang and, all, you know, and Curtis Blow and...
okay. I'm sorry.
Did I go somebody, too far back?
No, Curtis Blow. I mean, well, he was talking about Curtis Blow. He was talking about some things. And then it was, you know, Grandmaster Flash and Broken right. Glass everywhere. People yes. pissing on the sidewalk. I mean, even that, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. Like, even that was storytelling at its height. It wasn't glorifying.
Yeah.
It was storytelling. It's Donna Summer. There's no S on Summers. I apologize. You know, I will misspeak on these airwaves and be corrected. Donna Summers, to me... She, you know, MacArthur's Park still has me in a chokehold to this day because I'm trying to figure out why somebody had to cake out in the rain. I don't know what that song was about. I just didn't understand it, but I was singing my heart out. Donna right. Summer. Okay. All right. I watched her documentary.
But, you know, Karen, you said, what are they angry about or what are they upset about? I think genuine joy really pisses some people off. Genuine, that genuine joy that just your soul is singing for no other reason than, you know, I'm out here running around. I got bills and all that other crap, but you know what? I'm a melanated, healthy, beautiful Black woman with hair that is growing like crazy. And I'm just so happy and pleased with myself, you know, not for any other reason other than I took the time to get smart and to tackle things that I felt like were important to my mental health and trying to live the best life that I can live. And I think that is, when I look at, again, back to, like, when I look at people who are so angry about pride, the people out here celebrating pride, and I'm like, if they're not bothering you, why is this, why steal their joy? Why, they're walking around with these, they look like curmudgeons. And for no reason other than people over here having a good time. So I think genuine joy pisses people off.
If you ever been stuck in traffic in New York, and didn't realize it was a pride parade. You might be a little pissed off. That has happened to me.
And I get like, that.
I'm trying to get home.
And I get that. But you're not like trying to denigrate somebody's whole lifestyle.
No,
because
I am not. I'm not. Yeah. I'm just being cheeky right now. But okay, apparently I am officially black because I put an S on everything. So it's MacArthur Park. It's not MacArthur's Park. So who is it? Doesn't belong to MacArthur? I've been saying it wrong the whole time. And why is the cake in the rain? Can somebody explain to me who left it out and why was it in the rain?
We're ready.
Want to welcome Kyla Herbert here. I Never Knew TV. What's going on?
Thank you. Hello.
All right. Glad to have you here. I want to get right into it. And the first question I have is, being with your background, why is it important for Caribbean parents to actively teach their children about their cultural heritage?
It's important because it's a part of their history. So when we're here living in America, a lot of times you just hear about American history, but we also have a Caribbean history, an ancestry that they have to connect with, in addition to their African-American heritage. So it's important that they learn about their history, about the people from the Caribbean who influence American culture, and let them know that they are a part of greatness from that aspect or that side of their family.
What can parents do to maintain that Caribbean culture within the house? Some households get very Americanized, you know?
Yeah, I would suggest continue cooking the foods that you grew up eating. Teach the kids about continue eating the foods. Also, expose them to different cultural events. So we have our South Jersey Caribbean Festival. That's a way for them to get exposed to different parts of the Caribbean culture. So there's the music, there's the food, there's the folklore tradition. And I think that's something that's missing a lot.
You brought up a great point. Can you speak a little more about folklore and the importance of it?
So there are a lot of Caribbean traditions that are similar in many of the islands. Some of them are slightly different. You have even from masquerade. The masquerade didn't initially start with the pretty costumes that you see. A lot of it had to do with similar to slavery, where people would sneak and dress up and wear the blackface or different costumes. So a lot of the folklore started with not being able to showcase their traditions and doing it in secret. And then it came out. Now it's popular. So, I mean, you have different types of cultural tradition. You have Garifuna tradition, which is from St. Vincent and the Grenadines, where they were exiled and went to Belize. They have a language that many people don't know about. So they have the language, they have the culture. So those things are important. I mean, you have the Junkanoo, that's in Belize, that's in Jamaica, it's in Bahamas. So there's a lot of things that regarding like the folklore and traditional Caribbean culture that needs to be maintained as well, because you know, generations are getting older, so the young people need to know about that.
So you are the president of South Jersey Caribbean Festival, right? What are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about Caribbean cultural festivals?
Some people think that they're easy to produce, that funding falls out of the air. And some people think that you get money from the city or different people, that you're just giving it and you are able to make it happen. But it's really not the case. I mean, I can speak personally for South Jersey Caribbean Festival and other local festivals. We rely completely on donations, grants, sponsorships. Our vending helps as well. So those vending fees that people pay help go toward our expenses. So depending on where you're having an event, sometimes maybe you get the venue at a discount, or maybe you don't. You have to pay for venue, you have to pay for sound. So many things that go into it that have to be paid for. So whether it's on a big scale or small scale, you know, there are expenses. So I think people need to know that these free events, especially, it takes a lot to make them happen. It takes a lot for it to happen. So all, you know, donations and support are always needed. What it takes. So in our, for what we do, part of what it takes is we're meeting throughout the year. You know, maybe we might take a few months off, but we're meeting to plan maybe what artists we want to have and create a budget of what we would like to see happen. We have to research grants and go after grants. And sometimes you apply for grants and don't get them. And then now and in the current climate, so funding has been cut. So some of the grants that were out there, they're not there right now, especially governmental stuff. And then also grants are competitive. So you have to have, you know, your paperwork together. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So that helps in terms of being able to apply for certain type of grants, but it's still competitive. So sponsorships, they're there, but they are more difficult to get. So, I mean, that's another option. And, you know, community support and donations, you know, things are tight for most people. So sometimes it's hard to get. So, I mean, you have to just have different streams of income to make these events happen. So,
and so this is a legacy thing for you, right? From what I understand, your father started it. And
yes,
I'm pretty sure you saw him struggle with it. Why did you take it up?
You know, so when it started, I was a part of it from the beginning. I was more behind the scenes, you know, doing paperwork and helping out. He was definitely more outgoing and he knew a lot of people. He had been involved in the Caribbean community in Philadelphia and New Jersey for a long time. So that helped to get it started. But he passed away in 2007, in March, actually, 2007. So from then until now, I've been leading the charge to make it happen. And I think the reason why I did is because I was involved from the beginning. And then I realized, like, it was how much of a part of me it was, and then a part of the community. Because even some years when I felt like we didn't have a good year, people always came out. They always said they looked forward to it. So I feel like it's not just about me and my family and legacy, but also the people in our community.
Why do you believe it's important for people, Caribbean or not, to attend the South Jersey Caribbean Festival?
Well, it's a free event. We work tirelessly to make this event happen. But also, it's a good way to be exposed to Caribbean culture. So you get Caribbean food, you get Caribbean music from the traditional steel pan that people are used to hearing. Also, the dance, the cultural indigenous dances. So, for example, this year we have a group coming from Belize. They're, I want to say, on tour from Dangriga, which is the cultural capital of Belize, and they're doing a Garifuna dance. So, like, those things are things that people don't always see. So that's another reason to come out, because you'll be exposed to aspects of the Caribbean culture that you don't typically see. You know, most people associate a Caribbean event with just the music or, you know, wearing costumes in a masquerade. But we are here to show that it's more than that. And the cultural aspect is very important to us. So also our organization is the South Jersey Caribbean Cultural and Development Organization. So that's a part of our mission, which is to promote Caribbean culture through music, art, and our cultural programs.
And can you tell the people the day, the address, and the time?
Yes. Yeah, so the 25th annual South Jersey Caribbean Festival will be on Saturday, July 12th from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Wiggins Park on the Camden waterfront, which is next to Adventure Aquarium. And that address is 2 Riverside Drive in Camden.
Thank you so much. Wishing you the best for your event.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Youth Ambassadors. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, we now invite the Honorable Mia Amor Motley, Prime Minister of the Republic of Barbados and outgoing Chairman of the Caribbean Community, to bring remarks. Let's welcome her.
Mm-hmm. Most Honorable Andrew Holness, Prime Minister of Jamaica and Chairman of CARICOM, distinguished colleague heads of government, and ministers representing their countries, members of the Cabinet of Jamaica, distinguished guests, all. It was in 2018, July, that I first addressed the CARICOM heads of government meeting as Prime Minister of Barbados in this very room, in this very town. I did so as a young, romantic, idealist, and a fervent believer of the regional integration movement. Today I stand to address you with scars and bruising, but still as a young, romantic idealist. And I say so, conscious that over the course of these 7 years, our community has perhaps seen more challenges than we have ever seen since attaining independence. Indeed, some may argue, more challenges than we have ever seen since the famous September 1947 Montego Bay Conference, which called for a regional integration movement such as we have to be able to allow us to more effectively navigate our development journey. We live in a very different world from 1947. But if ever there was a time for regional solidarity, it is absolutely now. And Secretary General, I thank you for outlining some of the concerns that we face. When I addressed the heads of government meeting in Barbados a few months ago, I made the point that this was a time for us to lay bare our hearts and to be able to speak frankly to build the institution that we want. I note that immediately as I finish speaking, there is going to be a song from Ramon Watson, from that great Caribbean icon, Jimmy Cliff. And the song that they've chosen is that I can see clearly now. But I wouldn't mind if they added to that not just the power of vision, because I think across this region we have that, but the power of trial and effort. And there is no better song. I call myself, in fact, a Jimmy Cliff girl. There is no better song than "You Can Get It If You Really Want, But You Must Try and Try, You'll Succeed at Last." It is against that backdrop that I ask us to reflect on a few things today. We met and understood that our region, like every other region across the world, is suffering from the vicissitudes of cost of living issues that are making it more difficult for ordinary Caribbean people to make each day and to go through each day and night. And the question for us as heads of government and heads of state is, how do we make it easier for people to sleep? And how do we allow them to be able to undertake that task of taking care of themselves and their families in the most easy of ways, in spite of what has been triggered globally through geopolitical issues and wars and conflict and disruption supplies? We have determined that our agricultural commitment, 25 by 25, even if we have not met it fully, has put us in a better place than we were 5 years ago. But what we must not do is to stop, because if we try and try again, we'll succeed at last. I
Against that backdrop, a number of persons on a trade delegation week before last went to Boa Vista in Brazil to begin to open up the trading relationships that will allow us also to access food and meat at much cheaper prices than we are currently doing so. It is true that the actions of the United States government in their promise to impose tariffs on all Chinese-made ships created a catalyst for movement in a way that we could not find on our own. And if anything, we must thank President Trump and the U.S. Trade Representative for that. Mercifully, there was a stay of execution on the imposition of that tariff a few months ago. And I want to thank the Caribbean Private Sector Organization for working with us as heads of government of the Caribbean community. An amazing 500 members of the private sector went on to a Zoom call showing that when our vital interests are truly challenged, we know how to find unity in this region. If we cannot open up greater supply routes, if we can increase our domestic production, cognizant, however, that we are constantly at risk of the climate crisis, decimating that which we are trying to do in terms of open field agriculture, then we can begin to recognize that we do have the capacity to feed ourselves more. The bottom line is, however, that there are still too many gaps. And the major issue of logistics, I am happy to report that there are at least two CARICOM member states that are now in the process of looking to acquire cargo planes to help us overcome the very difficult prospect of the movement of goods within this region. Equally, I anticipate that at this meeting at Montego Bay, we will have the presentation on the Inter-Island Regional Ferry from the private sector. And at this point, it is up to us to determine whether we have the political will to finally ensure that we can democratize travel through ships yet again in this region, knowing full well that with the federal maple and the federal palm, there were examples of it many decades ago, and that we have allowed ourselves to become purely at the mercy of air travel without recognizing that as islands in the Caribbean Sea, we have the ability to reach each other in good time and at cheaper fares than if we only use air to connect our region. Tomorrow, we shall also receive the completed work on the CARICOM external tariff CET and the rules of origin. And I want to thank all at COTED and Community Council for teeing it up. We did think that you were taking a little long, but it is finally here. The political judgment that has to be made by heads now is what are the items that will not compromise regional production that can have the bung rates continue to be reduced so that we can see more progress on the reduction of cost of living, particularly of food and sanitary items. But this meeting will not only see these matters. We have come before our region to speak specifically of other things that are threatening our existence as a region. We live in a world now where fake news, regrettably, is a key part of all that we have, and where the improper use of AI can sometimes stoke great fear and panic among our citizens. It is about time, therefore, that we as a region come up with a CARICOM validation mechanism in the absence of the providers of those platforms not taking the action to validate truth any further. And if we fail to do so, we put seriously at risk the stability of our democracies. In the last 2 weeks alone, my government in Barbados has had to put out as clear fake news, one that sought to ban President Trump from our country, one that sought to impose on Barbados travel advisories that didn't exist,
And it is almost as if this is a daily exercise now for our countries, because those who have nothing to do, as we learned as children, the devil finds work for idle hands. We need our own CARICOM blue tick to validate truth in this community. In addition to that, I ask us equally to look at the issue of where we are with respect to citizen security. Today, the heads of government of the Caribbean community met with the heads of judiciary, and we did so as an absolute item of respect on the part of both groupings. It was a historic meeting, and it was one that recognized, as your Chief Justice in Jamaica put it, that it is possible for the judiciary to meet, remain independent, but not isolated from the communities in which they operate. This is so critical, not just for the development of Caribbean jurisprudence, but also for the stability of our democracies. There is no country in this region that is not facing some level of citizen insecurity. And regrettably, I've said over and over, we pay a high price for the Second Amendment rights of the United States of America's citizens. But whatever the cause, the reality is this is where we are. If ever there was a time for us to cooperate, as we discuss today, on matters pertaining to this, and Jamaica has put on the table a regional justice and security framework cooperation agreement, which I believe the rest of us are ready to engage in, because it is consistent with the Needham's Point Declaration of 2023 that was settled by the Caribbean Court of Justice Academy and the judges of the region. It is consistent with the George Bridge Declaration of November 2024 that was settled by the CARICOM heads of government, and it is absolutely needed by our citizens if we are to see safety be the primary concern of our people, from Jamaica and the Bahamas in the north, to Belize in the west, to Barbados in the east, to Guyana and Suriname in the south. And of course, underpinning all of that is that wonderful island chain of the Eastern Caribbean states. We have a duty to our citizens. It would be remiss of me not to salute Winston Anderson, the new president of the Caribbean Court of Justice, and may I say the president of my own Court of Appeal, final Court of Appeal in Barbados. And you will forgive me, having been the one who was the chair of the preparatory committee for the establishment of the Caribbean Court of Justice, you will forgive me if I now make yet another appeal to the citizens of this region to allow their governments to know that there ought to be a singular purpose for the Caribbean Court of Justice to be truly the last court of appeal for the states of this region. We are aware that there are some countries that have the requirement of referenda. But this, like everything else, ought to be the subject of public education. And if we can so do, then I believe we can finally start to move the needle generationally for us recognizing that this ought to be our final court. Our reality as small states is not only to be taken into account when dealing with the WTO and the need for special and differential treatment, or the international financial architecture that requires us to move away from the reality of assumptions with historic per capita GDP and not understanding the vulnerability of our countries as small states. But our small, vulnerable states are also to be taken into account with respect to our Caribbean jurisprudence and for how we treat to the issue of citizenship security, particularly as it relates to sensitive matters that will see persons who have been charged continue to move in our communities with impunity and taking action against other citizens with impunity. Let me, however, also reflect that over the course of this last 6 months, one of our major, major concerns was the stability of Haiti. The world really needs a check on itself. when it comes to Haiti. If ever we doubted that they were first-class and second-class citizens in the eyes of the world, don't doubt it anymore. In Haiti, more people were killed last year, in many months of last year, than were killed in any other country on earth, including those that were at war and the subject of military conflict. And in spite of that, and in spite of the promises, the world has been able to move, has been unable to move beyond the promises and the platitudes that would bring help to the people of Haiti. I'm not only talking about the loss of life. I'm talking about the displacement of citizens from their homes. I'm talking equally about the food insecurity of the people of Haiti. And let us be real. Our capacity as a Caribbean community has limits, purely because of size and capacity financially. We can help as best we can, as we must. But the world is what is needed as well at this point in time, beyond simply the deployment of troops from Kenya, without the requisite support in terms of machinery that is necessary to ensure that those Kenyan troops and others are not sent like lambs to the slaughter, along with the members of the Haitian police force. That Haiti is trying as best it can to be able to withstand the assault by gangs is to be commended. But at the same time, it is not enough. And what is required more than ever is for a truth talk, both within the context of what is possible from Haiti's perspective, but equally what is possible from the international community. And I fear that the absence of that realistic conversation will continue to mean that ordinary citizens will have their lives put at risk. And if not their lives, their limbs, and if not their lives and limbs, their ability to live as dignified human beings. The pace at which progress is needed must be expedited if we are not to see more and more people suffer. At the same time, in the last 6 months, we have had the issue of the spectacle of near difficulties with the border security situation between Guyana and Venezuela. I thank Prime Minister Gonzalez yet again for continuing to play a serious role along with Prime Minister Skerrit in ensuring that we could have the principles of the Argyle Declaration continue to be respected, even if in a tenuous way. And I recognize that this is going to require our continuous vigilance as we go forward, because we are all committed to seeing the Caribbean as a zone of peace at the level of the state and equally at the level of the citizen with respect to citizenship, security, and insecurity. We have unfinished business. The Caribbean Educational Transformation Commission must be established as a matter of urgency. For all of us continue to adhere to an educational system that is not fit for purpose for our citizens today. And we need to make those changes informed by data, informed by evidence. But the longer we take to put that commission in place, the longer we take to make the changes that are necessary to give our young people the best possible chance. Equally, we are required at this time to recognize that there are actions outside of this region that will demand our solidarity. I speak specifically as early as this week of the actions of the European Parliament with respect to the failure to delist countries like Barbados and Jamaica, who have come off of the Financial Action Task Force list for more than 1 year, but for whom we remain on the European Union's enhanced delegated list, along with countries like Gibraltar and UAE that are the subject of their opposition, but because of a technical mechanism by which they remove countries, Barbados and Jamaica continue to suffer at the hands of the listing process when we have been deemed to be fully compliant with all of the obligations required of us from the Financial Action Task Force. It is wrong, and if it was the shoe on the other foot, if the shoe was on the other foot, we would be told how to find ways of having our parliament change the manner in which we address this issue rather than grouping all of the countries in one basket to be the victims of any opposition on any country in spite of the progress made by our countries. I raise these issues because, as I said at the beginning, if ever there was a time for us to celebrate solidarity and to be able to work together, it is now. And I am not daunted whatsoever by our failure to get it in one go. And that is why I said that at the beginning, I am a Jimmy Cliff girl. We can get it if we really want, but we must try and try. The CSME was the subject of a dedicated conference when we left Montego Bay on the last occasion. And it resulted in the St. Anne's Declaration in December of 2018. But there are some difficult issues that we must confront. And we have heard one prime minister and one leader of the opposition question the validity of this entity within recent weeks and months. But if we are to be honest with ourselves and with our populations across this region, and we must start the public education process, it is largely because of our inability to find an appropriate mechanism for the funding of the CARICOM Development Fund. And even if every country in the region put money in it, it would still not be enough to finance disadvantaged countries, disadvantaged sectors, and disadvantaged regions, which are the consequence of any single market and single economy. It is against that backdrop that I've asked that we look at taking some of the excess regional liquidity that exists and finding a way with the cooperation of those who can help us put the guarantees in place so that our region can start to finance our own development. There are only two countries in the region who provide interest rates in excess of 5% for savings. The majority of CARICOM countries have interest rates that are below 3%, and therefore we are in a position to be able to offer the opportunity for the participation of CARICOM bonds to our citizens at rates of return that are competitive with private commercial banks but are still lower than the lending being offered by to many countries on the international capital markets. At the same time, in the last 6 months, we have done significant work to advance for the first time a regional debt swap initiative. My own country, Barbados, has now done two debt swap initiatives, one for nature and one for climate. In both instances, we have increased our capacity in respect of the nature one for marine sustainability trusts and with respect to the climate one for the construction of a new South Coast sewage treatment plant without increasing our debt by a single cent. And that is simply through the use of the regional debt swap initiative. The president of the World Bank, the president of the Inter-American Development Bank, the president of the Latin American and Caribbean Development Bank, and the president of the Caribbean Development Bank have all come together to lead this region on the regional debt swap initiative. And so attractive has been the proposal that countries like the Dominican Republic and other Central American countries have indicated a desire to be part of this regional debt swap initiative. In our own case in Barbados, we have determined that our next debt swap will not be for climate, but will be for the social sectors. And we look forward to other countries in the region joining us, such that this Caribbean community region will lead the world in having the first regional debt swap initiative globally. In addition, may I remind you that there is also the natural disaster clauses which ought to find primacy of place in all of our international and regional financial instruments. Our country just went to the capital market and raised $500 million and included in those bonds are natural disaster clauses and pandemic clauses, ensuring that for the first time, if we should be hit Somebody knock some wood for me, please. If we should be hit by a hurricane of a certain threshold, that we are in a position to pause the payment of our debt, both principal and interest, for 2 years, and not have to do what befell the people of Dominica, who had to look for debt payments immediately after Hurricane Maria, instead of being able to focus on shelter and food for their citizens at the very time that a hurricane has hit. And the notion that we are safe from a climate crisis can be immediately debunked, because week by week, with the latest being the tragic circumstances befalling the children of the United States in Texas with the raising of the banks of the river, of the Guadalupe River, reminding us that none of us can escape the hands and clutches of the climate crisis. So my friends, I ask us, please, to recall that there is much work to be done. I have not spoken to you today about the necessary work of the reform of the governance of this community and the funding of this community, because I believe that the heads of government must confront it and not believe that we can continue to wear the garbs of 20 and 30 years ago as we live in a world that is completely different today. And we must find the boldness, I believe our preacher told us today, Bishop Pitkin, when you said to us, let us have the boldness to move thought into action. Because without that, our region will not be ready for the defense of small states. It is my view that in the absence of an international rules-based order, and we are seeing it being threatened day by day, in the absence of an international rules-based order, countries such as ours will find it difficult to survive. And this, my friends, is the first real threat that we have had since becoming independent nations. The notion that others may want to conquer again is not beyond their imagination and not beyond our reality. But equally, the price of sovereignty is no longer simply that which we have started to do in the first two or three generations since independence. The price of sovereignty now extends to our ability to control our information and to generate our content. We have to be able to own our own satellites and not be the victim of somebody pulling them on us because they do not like the position.
You are listening to One to One with Kevin Amos.